Well, hi, everybody. How are you now? We are thrilled to be speaking with a good friend of the site, Cody Partridge, a guru, a Sherpa, all positive things. Speaking in the terms of music supervision, he's a ninja, he's a ronin, he's a cowboy, if you will. But he's the one who puts the cool music that you see and hear on TV shows and movies on said TV shows and movies. So without him, you probably wouldn't get the cool vibes of a soundtrack. So Cody, man, it's been a while since we talked to you. You've had a lot going on. What's happening in your world?
Oh man, you know, we're busy over here. Since we last spoke, I've started my own company. Still trucking forward on a whole bunch of really cool projects, from film to television to advertising. It's busy, it's steady, but in the best of ways. So I'm just living the dream over here as I try to do. So
yeah, you started Pear Tree Music Supervision, did I get that right?
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get into it, but there was the tragic passing of my mentor, David Heyman, and things were kind of happening with Supergroup of kind of closing up. So it was kind of like, what's the next chapter? And I was like, you know what, if I'm gonna take the leap and try something on my own and bet on myself, if you will, let's do it. And then I was trying to come up with a name, and I didn't want to just be like Cody Partridge Incorporated or something like that. So I was trying to come up with a name, and my wife was like, oh, do something like Two Turtle Doves or something. I was like, well, that's lame. And I was like, wait a minute though, what about Pear Tree? You know, it's synonymous with the Christmas Carol. Yeah. The name works, but if I ever wanted to expand beyond just myself, it wouldn't be like, you know, I'd have somebody working under Cody Partridge Inc. It would be kind of more of a, you know, again, a broader company as opposed to just kind of an incorporated person. So that's kind of how I came up with the name, and it works. And it's always nice whenever I'm working with new clients and they don't really get it. And then all of a sudden it's like, ding, and they're like, oh, okay, that makes Pear Tree. Like, why would you? But okay. So yeah. So that's kind of where we're at with the company anyway. But
well, it sounds much more professional than Lords of Leaping or Ladies Dancing. So,
right, exactly. So, and it's all in the public domain. So, you know, I'm good with that too. So, any reference, there's no copyright issues. So, you know.
Oh, perfect. Well, no, that's great. You know, I was talking to Dave McLean, who is a pretty legendary music promoter. He's worked with Iron Maiden, or booking Iron Maiden, and he's managed Placebo for decades. And we were just talking about, you know, what the... when something gets in your DNA, when you hear something for the first time, it just stays with you for the rest of your life and kind of cements your music taste moving forward. We always like to go back to the very beginning when we talk to guests and talent. So if you can think back on the things that kind of held a formative note in your ear, what are some of the things you grew up on and things you gravitated towards?
Yeah. So it's actually still the stuff I'm into nowadays, to be totally honest. But like, I was raised in started with like the boy band era, to be totally honest. So like, okay, you know, from O-Town to NSYNC to, you know, even like smaller Canadian artists like Soul Decision or the Moffats or like Prozac and stuff. Like those were all kind of
Prozac. Yeah. I'm sorry, right? To cut you off right there. Yeah. I know Prozac, only the Sucks to Be You. That
Sucks
album.
To You. Wow. Yeah, exactly. www. Never Get Over You. Like all those. Yeah, man. Like, you know, again, being Canadian, they were all the rage when I was like 10, you know what I mean? So it was like, that's definitely kind of where it started. And then I transitioned, which, I don't know, to me kind of seems like a natural transition, but I really got into like the pop punk, which was basically like the cool boy bands of the, you know, early 2000s of like, you know, Blink-182, Newfound Glory, Motion City Soundtrack, those kind of things. That, you know, you could just kind of sing along, bop along to kind of thing, but they had a little bit more edge than, you know, necessarily like O-Town, if you will. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wasn't embarrassed to say I was into Blink-182 and Newfound Glory, but at the time when you're young, you know, you don't have I guess you have the social parameters of like, no, boy bands, ew, or, you know, then I go to my room and blast Backstreet Boys or something. But anyway, so yeah, so I kind of started there, but now I've kind of, you know, I've totally opened up the floodgates, if you will, especially going on my own. Like I'm no longer kind of the admin guy, like I do all aspects. So it's really helped to open up my music taste. But you know, whenever I'm driving in the car and that, I always go back to my roots, or like, you know, even I love like Machine Gun Kelly's new album in the pop punk world. Like that was a really great transition that he made. And I've really been into those records that he's been putting out and those singles. But yeah, kind of the pop punk world has always been, you know, my kind of zone, if you will.
Absolutely. Excellent.
Doesn't often translate to the business side, the music supervision side, because, you know, unless you're doing kind of a, you know, you think back to like American Pie and that, where they had Blink in it, they had like all of those, you know, I think Newfound Glory even made a couple appearances in some of those shows, but like, or those films. But once they kind of got out of that being the immediate, like, you know, the setting, the time frame, pop punk hasn't really resurged, I've found, in the sync world. It's just, not, you know, the singer songwriters, the claps, the ooze, the, you know, and it goes through phases too of like, you know, trends, as we call it, you know, especially in like in the advertising world. Like there was a time there where it was what we coined around the office was sadvertising, where everybody wanted to be that, have the tear jerking commercial. You know what I mean? And then it kind of transitions into like those classic rock tracks that everybody knows from the first note. You know what I mean? So there's trends that I see, and I'm just waiting for the day where there's a, you know, a pop punk resurgence. You know, the other time I've gotten to do, like, I cleared a Backstreet Boys track for an advertisement, and that was kind of like a win for a younger Cody kind of thing, of a like a hell yeah, let's do this kind of thing. So yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, man. So anyway, so that's, well, where I kind of root from. So
that's excellent. Well, I want you to feel better, because I was a fan of Newfound Glory. I got into Zebrahead after college, and then you know, Newfound Glory did this awesome, I think it was called At the Movies or something. It was a co-op from, with Nicotine, Japanese band.
And yeah, they did, like, they also did that From Scenes to Your Stereo, where they did classic songs from movies and they re-recorded them. So like even on the third one, like, you know, they did Eye of the Tiger, they did Let It Go from Frozen and shit, and that's it's so good in the pop punk world of like these classic hits of like, yeah, good stuff. I love Newfound Glory. Their newest album was great too. They're still doing it all these years later, so good for them. So
you know, there was a band that I used to love and I still do, Goldfinger. They're Southern California ska punk band.
Absolutely, you know, get them from the Tony Hawk's Pro Skater.
That's what everybody says. Yeah,
Superman or whatever they had on there, and then I was big into them for a little hot minute there as well. Yeah, absolutely. No.
Well, you know, the thing with transitioning into music supervision, or, you know, like seeing the power that sound has against motion pictures, is there a couple tracks that when you were watching movies, at a young age, or even now, that just go, man, I can't believe that adds such gravity to the movie, or I first started to notice this at X moment.
Yeah, I mean, I can pinpoint whenever I was like, I know what I want to do for a living. I was watching The OC. It's the pilot episode, and it ends with Honey in the Moon by Joseph Arthur, whenever Ryan's driving away, and it's like that moment. And that was the moment where I was like, wow, that's like it. Like, what is that? Who does that? Right. And then I haven't had the pleasure of ever meeting Alexandra Pashrevaz, but someday it will. And I'll be like, man, like, you know, I'm sure she hears it a lot, but like, you're the reason I, like, you know, whatever, however old I was, whenever I was watching it, I was like, man, that, how do I marry music and picture? Like, wow. You know, what do you do there? So that was definitely the moment. And I mean, like, you can go back to the John Hughes movies. Like, I mean, you know, Breakfast Club and any of those are all iconic for their soundtracks. There's also one too. Again, I'm a big Nicolas Cage fan. There's a movie called Face Off with him and John Travolta, which is like my favorite movie of all time. And there's a scene where it's a big shootout. I don't know if you've seen it or not, but a big shootout. And they have Nicolas Cage's little kid there, and they put headphones on him to like get him out of the, and it's Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I think it's by Olivia Newton-John. I'm not sure if it is, but Somewhere Over the Rainbow plays. And I'm like, that's just such a unique, like, contradicting track to like the chaos, but then the beauty and imagery of Somewhere Over the Rainbow and the classicness of it. Like, I love kind of that diversity that things can do where they just pay off. And then in the advertising world, I don't know why this one sticks with me, but whatever the creative was, just works well. I couldn't tell you what the commercial was for, but all I know is Belly Button saying I'm coming out, and it was like a summer something. But and that is like the commercial that sticks with me for life, of like, I laughed every time I saw it. I was pretty young whenever I saw it, but like, it stuck with me, and I'm like, that's another, again, proof of like music making an impact, because like, it was probably 20 years ago 25 years ago where I saw that ad, but still to this day I can vividly remember it. And I'm like, that's really the impact that music has to support picture. And it's crazy how those memories do form. And then obviously, you know, again, to go on even more, but like, you know, even Rocky, right? Like think of the Rocky trilogy with Eye of the Tiger and
Gonna Fly Now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, those tracks are just so synonymous and iconic with that series. But you know, as soon as you hear the first notes of Eye of the Tiger, you know exactly what it is. And you're like, Rocky, I'm gonna run up the steps. You know what I mean? Like, and again, it's just that supportiveness that like, you know, it's really, it's that, you know, if you put it in a sports analogy, it's like the guy who always gets the assist. You know what I mean? Like he benefits the game drastically, or she benefits the game drastically, but they're not the glory. And that's really what I feel the position is of music supervisor is like, you know, I want to help a production be the best that it can be and help the creatives who created that production, their vision come true by supporting it with amazing music that enhances the film, doesn't necessarily steal the spotlight, doesn't necessarily, you know, overtake anything. It's just, it's there and it elevates that scene to the next level where it's relatable because it's a notable track, whether the groove of the song just fits the vibe that they're trying to make, you know, be felt within that moment of the scene. And that's really what I love about supervision is just being that assist, that enhancement, mm-hmm. you know, don't have to be in the limelight, just some moments they are, and that's fantastic. But, you know, it's more about building something strong to support somebody's vision creatively. And that's what I feel is really important about supervision, rather than doing, you know, 100 tracks in a half hour show, just because we're littering it with music that everybody knows, there's a creative art to it, or there's something that, you know, again, elevates it and doesn't need to steal the show that I really appreciate about it.
So. Well, I know we're going to get into Letterkenny in a bit, but there's one Letterkenny song used in Letterkenny at the end. It's at the end of the episode 2 in season 8, okay. And it's when Wayne gets over his depression, and he's watched the whole season of Misfire. And I don't know who the band is, but the song's called "This Too Shall Pass," and it just hits what's happening in the scene. And it's not even that impacting. It's just Wayne getting over it. His friends surround him. And it just, you know, makes it 10 times more impacting than it would be all by itself. I love that.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's definitely a big kudos to Jared. Because, you know, for a lot of the big moments in Letterkenny, especially, like Jared writes things in. Jared's very hands-on with Letterkenny. And, you know, again, a lot of the creative decisions, I would say 99 to 98% of the big moments are Jared, maybe even 100%. And I'm there to obviously support and clear the proper rights and that. And I kind of get my lips wet with the kind of the background and all the other additional music. But like those big moments, you know, he could write a script a year and a half in advance of actually completing the scene, actually seeing it on picture, and he's thinking of what songs need to go in there. So that one's actually by OK Go, I believe. That Too Shall Pass. Yeah. This Too Shall Pass. Yeah. And it's just, you know, so you got to give credit to Jared absolutely for kind of those moments he writes them. And that's a great example of, again, the music supporting the picture of, you know, it's not necessarily that it has to be a Taylor Swift song or a song by an Elton John song, something that everybody knows, you know, but OK Go is a big enough band, but also This Too Shall Pass is just like, it works sonically so well that it doesn't matter who's performing it. You know what I mean? Like, and that's the beauty of the, you know, the assist of the music. So, but no, that one definitely, I'm going to give full credit to Jared on that one. And it just like, you know, and the mixers who kind of, and the editors who made that scene what it was, like, I agree with you. It's a fantastic scene. And that music just really kind of puts that cherry on top for like the delivery of it. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for explaining that. And why don't we go back just a little bit, maybe not as far as Newfound Glory, but like what else inspires you? What did you like to do growing up? What helped sort of set you on this pathway? And what were some of the first steps into the industry?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, I always played in bands growing up. Like, I mean, we were never any good, but like, you know, I dabbled in everything from kind of like a rock band to like a hardcore screamo band that, like, you know, I was never into that. Again, knowing my interests of pop punk and, you know, boy bands. Like, I'm a bass player in like the heaviest hardcore band you've heard, right? But, you know, that was the trend at the time in high school. And then I transitioned and I went from playing bass to playing synth in a rap rock group where we had a rapper and did some rock. And then I kind of got out of that and was like, you know, I'm not really good enough at instruments to like try to make a go of this. I'm much more like, if I get on stage, you know, I'll run around like a chicken with my head cut off and try to be entertaining, but I'm not about the musicianship. That's just not my forte. So then whenever I took a music business course at Durham College in Oshawa, and on one of the first classes, they were like, yeah, here's some jobs you can do in the industry. And they kind of like breezed over music supervision. They're like, it's kind of like an A&R rep, but you work with film and television. And that was the last thing I heard about it in a 2-year program. And I was like, well, wait, what's that about? And then that kind of got me into it. My uncle was also big into kind of the music industry on the management side. And then he ran all the entertainment for a couple of casinos.
Cool.
Kind of in Vegas for a little bit, in Minnesota, Falls View Casino in Niagara, and that. So that kind of was one of my first steps into the industry. Was like, you know, I'd go and I'd spend a couple weeks with him in the summer, and like, you know, he'd be putting on his own production, and or he'd have, you know, all these artists come in, and it's kind of like the showrunner and, you know, artist wrangler, if you will. And that was kind of one of my fortes, like, oh, maybe I'll try that, like that seems really cool. But then whenever I got into supervision, I did a couple internships with Michael Perlmutter over at Instinct Entertainment, and then I transitioned to David Heyman over whenever he was over at Vapor. And as soon as I kind of got my first experience, it all those flooding memories of the OC came back of like, that's the childhood dream, like how do I make this work? So that's kind of, yeah, what I was into. And I've always been into film. Like at one point, I think I had a 3,500 DVD collection of just wow. Like all the movies, you know, I could get my hands on and, you know, just watch. That's all I did was watch movies and TV shows and like, you know, get into it and like, oh, what's the soundtrack, this, that kind of thing. But yeah, so that's kind of my interest. And then, you know, the other thing, the odd things of like, you know, I played lacrosse and all that jazz, but that wasn't really what I did. What I did mostly was music, and you know, when I wasn't playing with the guys, it was you know, watching movies and trying to watch as many as I could watch kind of thing. So yeah.
What sort of exhibition did you do when these bands were playing? Did you sell out friends' high schools or garages? What was the venue?
Yeah, so there was a couple, we played like a church once, which was really weird because it was all like Christian musicians and then us, and like our front guy was more like, how many times can I drop an F-bomb and offend the whole crowd? And it was just really uncomfortable. There was an amazing, like it's legendary now, but in Oshawa, because like, so I'm from Whippy, Ontario. So next town over Oshawa, there's a venue called The Dungeon. Which was actually below a Laser Quest, which is pretty cool. But it's like, it's no longer there. They may have tried to revive it. I don't know. I moved away since then, so I'm not too sure what's going on in the local Oshawa music scene. But it was like, that was the place to play. Like everybody who was touring that wasn't like big would play The Dungeon. Like, you know, you'd get like, I'm just trying to think of what artists came there, but like, it was everybody. Like, I think even, shit, who were we just talking about in the Tony Hawks that you were saying you were into?
Goldfinger.
Goldfinger played it. I think, like, you know, Billy Talent, I think at one point played it. Like these bands before they were like huge, like if you were coming to the area, you played The Dungeon kind of thing. So we played there a couple times. And then, yeah, just kind of, I don't know, touring around. We didn't really play any high schools or anything like that. It was just kind of more, there was like 5 or 6 local bands that just kind of did shows wherever any shows would pop up. We played like, I guess, the local pubs at, whenever I was in the rap rock band, we played local pubs at the college and stuff like that a couple times. So yeah, just kind of toured around there, but.
Sounds like something that, would be fun to do, get it out of your system, you know, have your younger fun years and, move on to more, professional leaning.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And again, like I said, I definitely was not any good really at the instruments. Like I said, I picked bass specifically because I was like, oh, I could learn guitar, but I was like, well, no, because then if I miss, like, you'll notice if I screw up. Whereas I'm like, well, bass, especially in the live setting, you know, I'm probably turned down a little bit. The drums are overpowering me anyway. If I just run around and don't play a verse, nobody will really notice. You know, maybe it'll feel a little empty, but whatever. And then same with the synth is like, you know, we had two guitarists at the time in the band, and I was like, the synth's really just adding a little extra wah or whatever. So I'm like, I can play the guitar lines, but if I don't do it, it's not going to blow the show, and I can go around and take it out in the crowd and have other people play it or whatever. Like one time I stripped down to a Speedo on stage and stage dove. Like we had a signage that was actually a diving board that we flipped down in the last song, and I dove out into the crowd and like, yeah, we're just kind of stupid shit just to like, you know, have fun and get people talking and that. So
excellent.
That's all it was, not the music part. Cause like I said, that's the professional side now, but so that's kind of how foray into it, if you will.
Well, yeah, gosh, I've never done anything remotely like that in my life. I play guitar, played saxophone in third grade. I played a mean sax, and then I gave it up. But wow, I'm kind of in awe, Mr. Partridge. That sounds like there's a book waiting to be written.
There you go. I've got some stories that could be, you know, we can go on and on, have a beer sometime, and we'll get some of those out. But anyway.
So just moving back to with your uncle booking these acts for casinos. So how closely is it the method or procedure? How closely does that and music supervision align?
Yeah, so that's actually a very interesting question. So like I said, I only dabbled with it kind of, you know, I went into this music business program for college, and like that summer I went up and kind of helped him run a show he was getting off the ground and that. But I mean, I guess realistically, the biggest transferable aspect of it would be probably the organization skills. Because like supervision and like, you know, everybody, whenever they think of music supervision, they think of the sexy side. They think of like, I'm going to put whatever I'm listening to, I'm going to tie it with this film and it's going to be awesome. Like that's maybe 10% of what we do. Realistically, 90%, I would say, is the back end. We have to find out rights holders. We have to make sure that we have, you know, 100% of both master and publishing cleared. And like, you know, you get into songs like, I don't know, songs like Biggie or something like that, like by Biggie or something like that, and you got samples in there, and then you got like somebody who owns like 0.06% of a song, but you still got to track down that 0.06 if you're going to use it, because you need 100% like approvals. Being organized and knowing, you know, crossing T's, dotting I's, making sure that everything aligns so there's no missing pieces or, you know, things like, oh shit, I didn't clear that, or oh, I didn't get the terms right, or I didn't do this, or it's not cleared for that, but they need the rights for this or whatever. That's kind of a transition, because like if you think about, you know, getting talent to perform, well then you need to make sure the riders are all up to speed. You got to make sure you understand, like, you know, the set list, how many songs, what criteria do they have, like will they allow flash photography, will they not, and you got to kind of organize the whole event and make sure that it goes off without a hitch. And that's very similar to organizing an entire soundtrack of a film and making sure that all boxes are ticked and there's nothing that can come back on production in a lawsuit form, or, you know, they go with distribution. They're like, hey, you don't have this injunctive relief language. Well, I should be responsible for figuring that out in advance. So like, you know, supervision is kind of, we take care of the music aspect because the producers have a million things on their plate. They shouldn't have to worry about music. Whereas, you know, being a showrunner or a talent handler, you know, the show has so many aspects to it. They shouldn't have to worry about if the talent's going to be on stage at the right time. That should just be done. Right. Yeah. And that's kind of the transition, I guess, the, you know, again, common threads between the two positions. Now, I never actually dabbled too much in the live performance. I've actually done it more with Supergroup, where I worked like Arkells, Walk Off the Earth, Elwins, you know, Sheepdogs. Like I was a talent wrangler for them, actually. So that's something that kind of translated from initial interest because of my uncle's profession that I kind of had a slight experience in, where I worked with David and he wanted to get into the live aspect a bit every now and then. And it allowed me to actually try out the talent handling position, if you will, which is kind of cool because David gave me the opportunity to almost dabble in a potential career that I initially thought might be a cool interest, which, you know, always brought me back to like, no, I like what I do with supervision. That's kind of it's still the dream. So.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk about David. Yeah, you worked for We Are the Supergroup. How long was that, and what were the first couple projects?
Yeah, so it was actually pretty I guess it was close to 10 years. So I interned with David back whenever he was at a company called Vapor. And I interned with him for about 6 months. And then I was like, oh, I got to start, like, I got to find a job. So I left in December, and the next March he left Vapor to start what at the time was called Supersonic Music, Supersonic Creative and Consulting, I think it was called. At which time I was like, okay, great. Well, that's two options there. There's a position open at Vapor now, or I can kind of reach out to David and see if I can be his right hand and just kind of do everything he doesn't like doing. You know, so like, again, the clearances, the paperwork, the keeping all that organized, because David was an incredibly creative person. And a lot of the times, if you have the super creatives, they don't care about the admin side. They don't care about the crossing the T's, dotting the I's. They have, you know, they want to be the creative. So I was like, okay, great. Can I be the right-hand side of his brain that just does, he doesn't have to think about it. He picks the songs, he does all the creative, and he hands it to me, and I seal it up with a nice bow and deliver it to production or whatever. You know, that would also make me indispensable, if you will. So he eventually, after knocking on his door and working three other jobs, but still, you know, I'm going to do this. He finally gave me a shot, and he's like, okay, I'm doing this last season of a show called Less Than Kind. He's like, you can be the coordinator on it, and you know, we'll get you doing that. Great. So I started there. Then I started working on a show called Saving Hope with him. And then I did my first feature film with him called Old Stock. And then that started to be like, okay, great. Now he's starting to really trust me. And then it kind of translated into, okay, you know, we'll pay you a flat fee. We can't bring you on, but we'll pay a flat fee and you do everything coordinator style. So I did that for about a year and a half. And then finally I got the call and he's like, okay, we're going to bring you on full time. Let's do this. So I quit my job at the bank as a mortgage specialist and all that shit. I was like, no, I'm going to go live the dream. And then we started that. And then probably 6 months later, there was another company called Supersonic that sent a cease and desist. So he's like, shit, I guess we got to change the name. And he hired two other people with me as well. So I kind of was there for a couple months. Then two other guys, Sean and Scotty, jumped on board. And then he made the transition to Super Group. And yeah, just took off from there and bounced around a couple different office locations. And yeah, and then, you know, suddenly in May of 2020, he passed suddenly. So that was pretty tough, pretty rough. And, you know, we've all just kind of think about him every day, but push forward and kind of try to keep his dream alive and, you know, keep doing it my own way. But, you know, honoring him every step of the way, because without him, you know, 10 years ago, I would have never gotten the shot. So, yeah.
Well, hooray for David. And he, you know, we spoke to him, gosh, not long before he passed away in 2020 during the pandemic. He was a jokester all the way. So do you have any like really good stories? And where did Huey come from?
So I think Huey was a name that he got like from camps growing up. He did a lot of like, you know, the kind of summer camps and, you know, the canoeing trips and all that jazz. And I think I never called him Huey ever. That was just not like a lot of his friends did. And, you know, people around the industry absolutely called him Huey. You know, we called him the doc around, we called him doctor around the office. So he was often the doc. So that's what we referred to him around the office as, but, I'm not too sure the origins of Huey, but I know that, you know, again, a lot of his friends, even now producers that I work with, refer to him as Huey that have known him for years. So I'm sure it's some sort of, you know, childhood nickname that he got. I want to say it had to do something with like DuckTales, like Huey, Louie and whatever. I don't know if that's true, but I feel like I heard some story about that. But Heyman was always just a jokester. Like, I mean, you know, he was very passionate about everything he did. You know, whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, it all depended on the situation, but he was very passionate and very opinionated. But he always was cracking jokes. Or, I mean, I even remember whenever we were on with you guys last time telling you that he was an interpretive dancer or some shit like that. And it took, like, there was lots of times where, like, you know, it'd take all I had to like keep the straight face, 'cause I knew he was just spewing it. And I'm just like, you know what, I'm gonna let this ride. Because he'll get everybody on the hook, because he just did it with such passion and convincing, you know, tones that I'm like, you know, they're biting everything. And this is like, wow, you were in an interpretive dance club and like you went on tours and shit. And then he'd be like, no, what are you talking about? I don't know. Like, what? Like, and like, just like reel you right in. And like, yeah, there was lots of that. That was, you know, and just the stupid jokes he would do around the office, or like, you know, just kind of, again, it was often, I'd say 90% of the time, just like lighthearted around the office, not stressful, just kind of like, you know, just having good laughs, you know, talking about how much my music taste sucked and, you know, good stuff like that. But no, it was good. Like I said, I couldn't have had a better mentor. By no means was he perfect. And was there a lot of times where I was like, man, what's going on? But, you know, those are definitely outweighed by the good times. So, yeah, he was something special. Let's put it that way.
And I like the way you described the relationship. You guys were kind of like a left brain, right brain, because you have someone who's like wildly, this is the way I'm going. And, you know, you get the other half of the brain and say, well, here's how we get there. And then you have tremendous success.
That's really what it was, you know, and often even in like negotiations, like he was the bull in the china shop. And I was kind of the guy who is always nice and tried to go the nice way. And he'd come in and be like, no, we're doing this. And then right shoulders would like, you know, they'd react to one of us and either, you know, work with somebody who is a little gentler approach or somebody who was bullheaded and like, no, like, this is why we need it done. This is what it is. Here's the deck. Like, you know, over explain it. And all aspects of what we did, it was very much kind of a yin and yang relationship. And I mean, I think that's why we also got along, because I never tried to step in his lane. He never tried to step in mine. We were never kind of overtaking each other. We just worked in tandem very well. And I knew, you know, whatever project came in the door through me, he would creatively kill it and knock it out of the park. And he knew whatever wild brain schemed idea he'd have, I'd figure out a way to make it work. You know, at one point he wanted to do a launch. I think he wanted to try to take Supergroup to LA and kind of do a launch event. And he's like, how do we fire a guy out of a cannon? So we had to be like researching, like how to, like, we never got there, but it was like, you know, those were kind of the ideas that he would just go. And like, I loved it too, cause like he would go on some random tangent. And then a week later he'd forget, like just not even acknowledge that he asked to do it. Be like, here's the cannon specs. And he'd be like, what the hell's the cannon for? And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, you like, you know, but again, that was part of his humor. That was part of his, like, he like probably laughed as, you know, even after he passed and like, I was helping close down the company, like we got into insurance and like he had taken out kidnapping ransom insurance just because, you know, he probably thought it was hilarious that he's like, yeah, if anybody wants to take me, like at least I'm insured. But it's like, David, nobody's ever going to kidnap a 6'5", like 300 pound dude. Like, that's not gonna happen. Like, he was a monster. And I'm like, all right, whatever, you know, that's just part of it. Like, he probably thought it was the funniest thing that he had, man, like ransom insurance. I'm like, all right, whatever. Like, yeah. But no, he was, like I said, great memories. I couldn't have asked for a better decade, let's put it that way.
That's phenomenal. Great things to keep close to your heart. Absolutely. You know, I imagine every project's got to be different. Is there one project or series or just something that's, you know, so atypical, or it's been, you know, a whirlwind to get through? And the reason I ask is because, you know, when you say that Jared, Jacob and Jared, they put all the music into it, and so kind of, you know, takes the guesswork out of it. But I mean, is that typical that the creatives have all the control, or do they ask for input?
Often. No, I mean, like, usually what happens, kind of the process is, you know, a lot of projects come with temp tracks. So like tracks that they slap in there, or the tracks that they put in there, and they, as reference for either what they're vibing, you know, even just to give you an indication of something, they, you know, whether it be like even the Beatles or the Stones or, you know, whatever it may be. And usually that's where I like to start, is like, okay, well, if that's what you envision, then can I clear those tracks for you? And I think that's from all the years of being David's right-hand brain, is my initial thought isn't let's get creative on this. It's let's just make your vision come true and see what we can do. But a lot of the times it's kind of like budget parameters, or the artist isn't into it, or whatever it may be, where we have to come up with creative solutions and be like, okay, great. Let's use that as our groundwork. So say we use Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles. Let's take that song. Let's take what you have for budget. And then I will go out and I will find tracks that work similarly. Obviously, you're not going to get the Beatles or anything that is the magnitude of the Beatles. It could be complete independent artists, but good solid tunes that give a very similar sonic sound to what the Beatles did, right? Bands that are inspired, et cetera, et cetera, and then build playlists off of that and then present options to production to utilize in the scenes in replacement of the Beatles to see if they like anything that aligns that way, right?
Okay.
And that's kind of the process of it. So, I mean, like, you know, there's some that are more challenging than others. You know, some productions have very strong creative mindset because, again, they're all creatives as well, right? The way that I always look at it too, and just to give a little more insight into my kind of outlook on the situation, is everybody wants to be the cool kid at the party. Everybody wants to throw the music that they love into a film, whatever. I'm more than happy to throw my ideas in the ring or be there as a solution. But if I'd rather not step on toes of the creative, you know, the cool kids and be there to support them and clear the songs that they want. But that's just kind of my outlook, which I think is a little different because a lot of people who get into this want to be the creative. And that's why I initially got into it too, is like, hey, I want to throw Blink-182 in all the films I work on.
That's like, Scorsese movie, Blink-182.
Exactly. Right? Very, very quickly did I get a reality check on that's not the way that this works. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of people who get into this think that, yeah, like they want to be the creative and they only want to be the creative. They don't really care about the admin side, where positioning myself with David of being that side of the brain, it made me get into it and really enjoy it. So then I found the interest in the admin versus people interested in the creative. So that gives me a little bit of a different approach to the business, if you will. But again, navigating budgets, like that's one of the biggest things that we have to do as a supervisor, is like not blow the budget, right? Mm-hmm. So like if we're with a limited budget and they want all these big known artists, like there's a reality check that we can't do that. So there's a process of convincing or providing good enough alternates that the production comes off of their temp love. And they're like, but we really love the Beatles. And it's like, but you don't have that kind of money. We can get any of these other, you know, 10 songs for something that won't break your bank. And they're great tracks. And finding tracks that, you know, again, entice productions as well as are budget friendly, that kind of work on all aspects. And that's really the challenge of a supervisor, is to make sure that we don't take a $10,000 budgeted film and the bill end up being $100,000, because like it's our responsibility to make sure that we make what they want fit within a budget and for the rights they need for distribution or whatever it may be. And, but sonically still satisfies their creative needs. So, you know, there's been many projects that have been, you know, more challenging than others. You know, sometimes it's as easy as like, hey, here's five options for creative options to replace those temp tracks. And they're like, great, we love this one and this one. Okay, perfect. Let's go clear it and be done. Sometimes we go, you know, there was one film where I went 8 rounds of presenting 30 options for one scene, 30 options a round. Okay. And then at the end, he's like, you know what, just, you know, I don't know, send me everything you've got. I said, okay, fine. So I put all 8 rounds in one playlist, as well as like another, probably, I don't know, 30 songs or something like that. So that's a lot of freaking tracks. And I sent them. And sure enough, what song does he pick? Something from the very first pitch I did. So it's like, you know, there's those frustrating moments too, where it's like, I didn't need to do these 9 pitches whenever realistically you settled on the one, but they also want to hear all the options. Like, what else is out there for the budget? What else can we do? You know? So those are kind of the challenges of dealing with production, but you know, it's a good challenge. Like it's not something that's defeating. It's something that's like, okay, you're not liking this. Let's go a different route. Let's try a different route. Let's try a different route. You know, like try to present them options that they don't even know they want, or stay so close to the temp track that, you know, again, they're satisfied right away. But maybe they didn't actually like the temp track. They just threw it in there because that's what they had on their iTunes. And they're like, yeah, something like this, but not really. And it's like,
oh, yeah.
So, but it's all about dealing with creatives and, you know, that's a challenge in itself, realistically. And I mean, that's not going to offend anybody, but creatives have very strong opinions and they have, you know, their mindset and they have their vision. And again, as we kind of talked about music enhancing the picture, the supervisor is to enhance the project, right? It's not necessarily for us to combat and be like, no, you don't want to use that song. You want to use this song, because I didn't write the script. I didn't direct it. I didn't, you know, so again, I see myself as a supportive member, a supporting cast member, as opposed to the lead, if that gives an insight as to my thought process on the position, but yeah.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, I love how you broke that down and the mindset behind it and all the hurdles you go through. So do you, I mean, this is kind of, this might be a dumb question to ask. Do you really have to give five options for every temp track just to sort of cover your bases?
Like, realistically, that's, you can set it with whatever you want or like deal with production. Like if you give them one, if you think you have the song and it works out and they like it, great. You know, yeah. I've done is, you know, three tracks, like three replacement tracks for a song. Sure. I've done it as high as 30. I've done as high as, like, you know what I mean? So it all depends on, you know, to me, the more options, the better. And again, this is my opinion because again, I can have a vision that may not totally align with somebody. So if I only give you one option or three options that I think work perfectly, but you have a different vision for the scene, they probably aren't going to align. Right. And if I give you 30, there's a better chance that it's kind of that spat, like a shotgun shell versus a pistol, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of me just trying to snipe you out, if I give you the blast, there might be something in there that if it's not quite right, but it could be closer to what you're envisioning, to which you can be like, I like this one, but it's a little too EDM. Okay, great. I can now use the temp track and this track to make a new list to kind of, you know, tighten. Like, the perfect example is I'm working on a film right now and they wanted a song for a car driving scene that was like, you know, those annoying teenager kids are listening to whatever they want to on the radio. And it's like, you know, they drive by and you're like, turn it down kind of thing. Right. I was like, great. And I put together some options and I was like, oh, a lot of these are too like EDM, too bass heavy. So I didn't pitch them. And then I had a call with them and they're like, oh, we were actually looking for something a little more heavier, like bass heavy EDM. And I was like, I have like 30 options that I didn't put forward because I interpreted it one way, but he wanted the way I didn't interpret it. So I had everything kind of stocked, ready to go because they didn't make my creative thought on the situation when realistically his creative thought was the B side of my pitch. So I was like, okay, well, that's great. Here you go. And then we found a track like that and it was easy, but that's just to show again, working with the creatives, everybody has their creative vision and realistically in the end, the production calls the shot. So the communication and clarity you can get with production really helps where you don't need to do the 30, but whenever they're not sure what they really want, the 30 really helps. And then the next pitch maybe is 10 or five, right? And you can kind of do it. That's kind of, again, my process is kind of go wide and then hone it down if nothing's kind of found in sequential pitches. So,
okay. Well, you know, what is really beautiful about watching Letterkenny is you and David share music supervision credits. And even though he passed in 2020, they just debuted the season 10 and it still shows you and David. So I think that's tremendously respectful, but is that maybe akin to how long it takes to clear things? Like, are you still working on clearing things from seasons before
or ahead? I make it as biggest point I can is, you know, in advance of locking picture, everything's cleared because again, I don't want any hiccups. I don't want any egg on my face, as David would always say, of like, you know, all of a sudden something can't clear, but picture's locked and it's in the mix. Well, what do you do at that point? Right. Then you got to go with your tail between the legs of production and be like, you got to open picture and we got to switch this out. I want to avoid that at all costs. So Does it take time? Absolutely. I think the season that came out of Letterkenny, I think it was like a year and a half we worked on it just because of COVID slowing things down and production and that. But then, like, you know, things turn around much quicker. Like Shorzy, for example, is coming out shortly, which is a spinoff. And like, we've wrapped it, but that only took like, I think it was like six months, I think, to get kind of all the music locked in and done in that. So, you know, it's the time frame is really a wild west of like, you know, sometimes I get an email. It's like, hey, we need to lock this next week. And we have six tracks we had to clear. Okay, let's get her done. Or sometimes it's like, hey, we're not actually mixing for another 8 months, but let's get started early. Okay, great. That's music to my ears. And then I, you know, prioritize in that. So I guess to answer your question, like, you know, to the best of my possible, like my ability, I will never go to air without anything being pre-approved. It may not be papered right away, but at least we have the approvals in place. I've been very lucky, touch wood, to never go to air with songs that do have missing pieces uncleared. Just because, again, I would flag that well in advance of locking pitcher, just being like, this is being an issue. It'd be a lot better if we could swap this out. You know, here's some options that might, that would clear faster. So then that way there's no loose threads whenever it's too late to do anything about it.
So, okay. Yeah. Well, last technical question, then we'll get into some fun stuff to round out this interview. I've spoken with the guys who do music release at Mondo Records. And so they were telling me that there are tremendous hurdles with clearing music. As you said, you know, you go to the composer, the studio, the musicians, and it goes down the list. And sometimes they were working on projects for over 2 years that actually never came to fruition. So I guess it is, what's more of a non-starter? Is it a fee that's too high for a track? Is it the lengthiness of clearing something that would maybe make it like you'd miss the season of TV, or things easier when someone's alive or dead?
Actually all of that kind of goes into the ask. So the number one thing is rights holders. So, you know, how many people are attached to the rights of the song, right? Because if you think about it, everybody needs a piece of the pie. So if there's 12 publishers attached to a song, then, you know, a $2,000 clearance or something on a lower end isn't going to fly, because that two grand needs to be separated between 12 publishers. So everybody sees, you know, less than $200 a piece if it's an even split. So that right there is going to drive the fee up. So if you get into it and it's like, hey, we want to clear this song, and it's like, wow, there's a, like, you know, again, 13 writers and 10 publishers representing those 13 writers. Well, you know, right there, that's kind of a red flag, not a red flag, but like, okay, but you're going to have to spend to get this track. Like, it's not going to be a quick, easy clearance, because we have to get 10 different people to sign off on, or 11 for the label as well. And then if samples are involved, that can all be very complicated. But nothing scares me at this point in my career of like, ooh, that's going to be difficult. It's like, well, let's just give it a shot, but let's have a contingency in place. But right, number of rights holders is something that often impacts whether a song will clear in time or clear on budget, et cetera, et cetera. Fees are also a big thing. You know, if songs come back drastically higher than what they have budgeted for, they've got what they've got in budget, and we just have to navigate that. Radio silence from rights holders. So if I reach out to somebody, and they just don't get back to me, it's kind of like I raise that as a red flag with production, being like, hey, I've got radio silence from this. I don't know if we can clear this. The smart move might be to replace it, right? Estates versus living writers. Again, it all depends on their reactiveness to emails, right? So if I go out to a publisher and they're like, yeah, we just got to deal with the estate. If the estate doesn't get back to them for 3-4 weeks, right? That again raises flags of like, hey, it's kind of radio silence. So I'd say the biggest thing is the radio silence. Like if people aren't reactive to my requests, then it's kind of like, okay, you know, give them a reasonable amount of time. But if it's, you know, going on 2 months and I have heard one email back or nothing, then it's kind of like, okay, this is making me a little nervous. I would look for other ways around to try to contact them. And if I couldn't do it or connect with them, then it's kind of like, okay, let's think of a contingency plan. I'll keep moving forward with plan A in hopes that somebody responds. But if not, let's get plan B approved so we can make a quick pivot at the last minute if we need to. So those are kind of all aspects, but realistically it's locking down to make sure you have 100% of the master and 100% of the publishing cleared. And with songs that have, you know, again, multiple writers with minuscule splits, because some guy delivered a pizza on recording day and they're like, yeah, let's give him 0.3% of the track. It's like, okay, he has no representation, so I have to go find some guy living in Florida and find his cell phone through his Facebook or something like that. Like, that's been done. But that's the whole like detective hat, as I've referred to in a lot of my bios, like the Indiana Jones of music supervision, where it's like, you know, nothing will go left unturned. It's a relic hunter. Like it's that search. It's that, right. And again, like I said, that's also what kind of like excites me and gets me like stoked on things, is like whenever there are a bit of challenges, I love the ones that are easy, like, okay, Universal, I'll contact Universal, we'll get her done. But then there's also those challenges of like, okay, let's do this. Like, okay, we'll find this person. Like one time, I don't remember the track, but like I was having the worst time finding one of the writers. I knew the writer's name, but could not find them. And I was talking to my wife about it, and I was like, man, I don't know. She's like, hold on. And she went into her crazy like social media mode, and she ended up finding the person's husband on Facebook and then somehow linking to a contact, and like I Facebooked her, and she's like, yeah, that's me. And I'm like, how did you? And she's like, oh, well, if you look in this picture, then that, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay, whatever. Like, but like, sometimes you have to go that deep of like, you know, crazy ways to get to somebody. I mean, obviously the more direct route, the more professional it is. Suddenly hitting you up on, you know, Instagram being like, hey, I think this is you. Like, can you confirm what email I should send a request to? But I, you know, sometimes that's what you got to do. But again, they all have their challenges. They all have their, I don't know, difficulties at times. Like every clearance has their own. That's also what makes music supervision interesting, is it's never the same day, because rights holders change, approving parties change. You know, even if I were to clear the same band six times, there may be a ghostwriter on a couple of them. Then maybe it's not necessarily just a slam dunk because I cleared them before. So yeah, there's a lot of aspects that go into the clearance that, you know, prove difficult, but then also are very rewarding whenever you actually get that, you know, sign off and you're like, okay, I did it on budget. Let's tick that box. Let's move on to the next. Right. So, yeah.
I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to title this episode as Cody Partridge Supervision, Music Supervision Masterclass, because it feels like you're giving more insight than you would learn in class. And I think the great thing about it is, yes, it's navigating these channels. It's having the wherewithal and resources to be able to just, if the door's locked, find another way in, or just, you know, reach out. But no, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, you have a movie, you have Riley Stern's Duel coming out. And funny enough, I'm going to speak to Riley in about 50 minutes
about
the movie. What was your experience on that? And do you have a preference TV to films?
Yeah. So I was approached by a producer that I worked with for years, Lee Kim, who is a producer on Duel. So that's who I dealt with. So I didn't have the opportunity to deal with many others on the production, but he approached me and was like, hey, we're doing this film. Can we get this couple tracks cleared? And I was like, absolutely. You know, whatever you need, I'm here for you. And it was a really cool experience. You know, we got to play with some bigger tracks, which is always fun. And we got it again, budget, which is always a big win for me personally. So things just kind of aligned and worked out well. So that was really cool. I got to see the film, which is really well done. You know, really enjoyed it as well. But yeah, for TV versus film, they're wild worlds. Like a film could take easily 6 months to 6 to 8 months. And then a TV show could easily take like a year to a year and a half to just kind of get everything done. So, I mean, they're similar in some respects, but then obviously you're dealing with a lot of thing, like a lot of different aspects, being even the format of it, you know, being 2 hour film versus an hour or 30 minute TV show. Budgets are completely different on the two. So like navigating that, you know, you clear something for a TV show and it's, you know, triple for film or vice versa or something like that, just because of the format. I really enjoy both of them. I actually really enjoy advertising, working for advertisements, to be honest. You know, again, it's kind of that corporate whatever, but like I work with a company in Canada called TELUS quite often, and they're dancing animals, and kind of finding that track that like helps tell the story they're looking for, portrayed by like, you know, lemurs or like zebras or something like that. Like it's a really cool experience of getting that visual and being like, okay, what can we do with a bigger track or even an unknown track that can like sell the product, but also like really tell a story in 30 seconds that people remember, similar back to my reference of that belly button commercial that stuck with me for 20 years. But you know, so that's a lot of fun. But honestly, I love working in film and television both. It gives me a lot of opportunities. Like I worked on Schitt's Creek, and that was really cool. To work with the Levies. Like I got to chat with Eugene Levy a couple times, and I'm like, well, childhood, you know, who watched American Pie and like all those movies. I'm just like, man, you're America's dad. This is really cool. Like, you know, like they all give me those opportunities of like, again, Letterkenny working so closely with Jared, like being like, yeah, I know Jared. Like, you know, we text all the time. Like it's really cool to have those moments, but then also creatively their input is really cool to work with, again, these established actors and producers that, like, you know, you see in the role on TV or in film, and now they have a creative sense as to what they're creating visually, like on their next project, and getting their creative input in something more than just watching them on screen doing their thing. That's a really cool aspect. So realistically, you know, film, television, advertising, I love them all. There's not really a preference. It's more the networking and an opportunity to work with these incredibly talented people. And they, again, dabble in TV and then go do a film. So it's like being able to work with all of these, again, incredibly creative people in different aspects and helping them have their vision come true. That's really what I love about it. Again, whatever the media is, it's being that assist. That's what I really, really enjoy. Yeah. So.
And I love how you clarified that a number of times during the session, because what one of the things I like to ask people on the show is, you know, there was a meme a couple of years ago, and it was an infographic. It was maybe like six pictures, and one says it was based on every profession. So it was, you know, what my friends think I do, what the public thinks I do, what my parents think I do, what I actually do. And it's always, you know, underwhelming, you know, but so I'm wondering, do people that you know what you do, or are they always hitting you up like, hey, listen to this song, try to put it in your show? And you're like, no, it doesn't work like that.
Not quite how it works. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of, again, all aspects, right? It's like my grandmother, before she passed, she's like, does he really work in the music industry? Like, is he not a drug dealer or something? Like, right. And I'm like, no, grandma, like, it's seriously, like, you see that commercial, like, I helped to create what it is now. Right. But yeah, there's a lot of people, like, I've had a lot of these conversations similar to this, where, like, you know, I'm very transparent as to what I actually do versus kind of the mystique of, like, the sexiness that I had getting into it of, like, yeah, they just throw whatever they want in there. Like, I didn't know about master and publishing clearances whenever I wanted to get into supervision. All I know is, like, man, the OC has a hell of a soundtrack. You know what I mean? Like, and that's still what a lot of people think of. Like, I know my wife hates it whenever I sit and watch a movie or a TV show, because I'm just like, I don't watch much anymore. Like, now I'm like, how'd they get that song? Man, they must have done a deal with this publisher. She's like, shut up and just watch the show, right? And like, it's totally put like, you know, my professional career has totally put a total twist on watching any sort of form of media, or like, oh, who did that commercial? Or like, you know, and I Google, like, okay, who's the supervisor on this project? Oh, okay, yeah, cool, they worked on this and this. And then being like, man, they must've had a budget. Or like, how'd they clear that? I thought that wasn't clearable. Oh, it's a cover. Okay, cool. Or like, you know what I mean? Like, and that's now how I watch TV shows and movies. So yeah, I kind of got off topic there. I forget the original question, but that's a little yeah.
Well, I think that's hilarious, because my wife and I, we're both in the interior design industry. So we work with architects, and we work on hotels and hospitality resorts. And the funniest thing was, and this happens kind of similarly, we're watching The Night House last night, which was about an architect who killed himself. And I watched Greenland with Gerard Butler. So whenever they have like somebody who's in the design industry, like, they always have to have blueprints, and the architect is always wearing a blue shirt, and they're always on site with a drafting board. I'm like, no, nobody uses drafting boards anymore. Nobody uses blueprints. Like, oh God, this is an archaic way of this. So it's breaking down.
You get it. Cause like, yeah, watching anything that has to do with your profession, you like nitpick it. And because my profession is in the industry, everything I watch has music. So everything I watch, I have some sort of like, oh my God, like, oh, that's too much music in that show. Or like, oh, that's, you know, that's an interesting choice there. Or, oh, wow, what did they do that? Right. So yeah, it's cool though, because I enjoy it. Like I said, my wife hates it, but I love it. I'm like, it gives me an added element to enjoy whatever I'm watching, because I'm like, I can look at it from a professional view, but also from an enjoyment point of view. So it kind of gives me a dual tone of appreciating what they did on screen. So
that's cool. Well, let's go back to just, you know, a couple more fun getting to know you questions. Are there bands or songs or music selections that you like that you know none of your friends do, or you're even afraid to tell people? You just like
placements that I've done, or
no, just on a personal, like, if you were in your car and nobody else was listening and you're playing it loud and you roll up to pick up your friend and you just turn it off, or you just stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, O-Town, like they a couple years ago, they released a track called Off, and that's like my jam. Like, anytime I can, I just like crank it and go off to it. But yeah, I don't know. Those years, I guess, have passed. I think probably from the years of Ridicule David is like, I'm now, I'm me, I'm comfortable in my skin, and I'm like, you don't like it, That's cool. I'm not the trendiest person. I'm not the coolest person. I'm not like, oh yeah, I got this record like a week before it came out. Like it's going to be the hottest thing. But like, you know, I appreciate that. And I do get those kind of exposures. I have to for what I do, but like personal wise, I'm like, yeah, if I can throw on the Blink-182 self-titled album, I'd listen to that all day, every day. And that's like what, 20 some odd years old now. I think it came out in 2007. I don't know, something like that. But so it's, you know, 15 years old or whatever it is. It might be a little earlier than that, maybe 2003 or 2004. But anyways, regardless. But yeah, I'm not shy about what I like anymore. There's no more, what do they call those? Guilty pleasures.
Guilty pleasures, yeah.
Yeah, it's everybody just knows that's me. They may tell me to turn it off or like, what the hell is this? But, you know, I'm just like, yeah, I wear myself on my sleeve. You know what I mean? Like I'm not shy about it anymore. I have that confidence now, just because. So it's not like in high school whenever I hid my O-Town record or CD or like, you know what I mean? Okay. Like, you know, it's just, yeah. So I don't really have the guilty pleasures anymore. That they're just my regular listening.
Okay. Fair enough. I was willing to share with you if you were going to go deeper than that, but we'll save it for another,
okay,
another day. I will tell you a guilty pleasure. Yeah. I grew up watching the movie Mannequin with Andrew McCarthy and Kim Cattrall, and there's some great songs in that, great characters. And I think top to bottom, that's something that people try to hide from. But you know, yeah. I love the music, I love the moments in that movie, and so no shame in proclaiming that on the podcast. Shame.
I respect you that much more just for letting that out there in the public. So you know,
you do thank you.
You do you, right?
Well, Big C, this has been a pleasure. I hope that you could tell us just to maybe a little bit of what's happening in the Letterkenny universe. Is it completely shifting off to Shoresy, or are we still going to get more of the Letterkenny group?
No, I mean, I guess, I don't know. I don't really have an NDA like thing to say. There's nothing really to shy, but there's definitely another season coming of Letterkenny. Definitely. Because I'm actively working on it as we speak. So Shoresy, I believe there's no set date that I'm aware of at the moment, but I think it's mid-May. It's going to be coming out. Don't quote me on it because I'm not 100% sure. Like I said, I'm still waiting on the dates from production of whenever it's going to be released. But yeah, I think, and then, yeah, that's as much as I know. And then New Metric Media, who also does, who does Shoresy and Letterkenny, they're also doing, they just got picked up for season 2 of a show called Children Ruin Everything that I worked on as well. So that one's coming in the docs as well. We're pre-production on that one, but it's a great little show as well, from the world, well, not the world of Letterkenny, but from the producers of Letterkenny and that. So it has some elements that are the same, but not quite the same demographic that they're trying to hit. Yeah. So, and then I got some movies on the go as well that are going to be coming out, which is great. Big one with Mel Gibson, Josh Duhamel, and Alicia Cuthbert. So that's a fun one that I'm working on right now, set in the 80s. So that's a great one called Bandit. And yeah, a couple other things on the go too. So busy over here, but like I said, in the best of ways.
That sounds like it's the dream come true, Mr. Partridge.
Living the dream every day, man. Living the dream.
Well, Cody, why don't you take us out and tell them where we can find you. Thank you for telling some of the things that are on your horizon. But how do we get in touch with you should someone need some supervision?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have website, peartreesupervision.com. There's a contact me link there. Otherwise it's through IMDb. I have my IMDb set up. You know, I think there's 100 and some odd credits on there. That's how you know it's me. And yeah, that's kind of, I don't have social medias or anything like that. I just kind of try to keep it, you know, somewhat low key in the respect of, you know, I'm here if you need me, and you can get me on by email, and that's kind of the best way to do it. And then, yeah,
that's well, cool. Excellent. Excellent. So yeah, so Cody will do the fighting for you. He'll be all hands throwing hands trying to get the tracks that you want on your project.
Yeah,
well, Cody,
I'll do my best. Let's put it that way.
Well, we will catch you next time, but everyone give a nice hat tip to Cody, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah,
see you, everybody.
So much. Thanks for having me.